Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Obama is walking across the stage accepting his presidency. And at that moment, for some reason, it clicked for me because I went out and I voted for him, but I was like, there's no way we're going to get a black president. There's no way this is going to happen. No way. And when he walked across the stage, I was like, what am I doing? This man defied the odds. You know, 55 years ago, we weren't even allowed to eat in restaurants. Like, that was the last restaurant that was desegregated. That's huge.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here selling drugs.
This week, it is my pleasure to have with me in the house, chef and memoirist Kwame Onwuachi. Kwame is the chef of Kith and Kin in Washington, D.C. He has just been named one of Food & Wine's best new chefs of 2019.
Yep.
And yet somehow he also found the time to write a fascinating and far-reaching memoir, Notes from a Young Black Chef. Welcome to Special Sauce, Kwame.
Thank you for having me.
So glad that you're here. And let me say that I really enjoyed the book. Congratulations on that. And also being named one of Food & Wine's best new chefs. You're kind of having a moment, aren't you, man?
It seems as so. I'm not going to...
You're kind of a skeptic here.
Yes, because I still have to go to service at night. You know?
Right.
So it's like I'm still very much in it. Cooking. But it is a great, great time. I'm very, very fortunate.
Yeah.
You know, to have these accolades right now, you know, and the book coming out. And we've been working on the book for so long. It's like we were talking about it, you know, briefly before this. It's a process.
Yeah.
It's not 6 months, you know, it's like two and a half years.
And every time you sit down and write your memoir, it's like an hour's worth of therapy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Every single day for 2.5 years.
So you were in intensive therapy.
Yes.
I know it, intensive. Man. I was the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about life at the Onwuachi table growing up.
Life at the Onwuachi table growing up, I would say, was, for the most part, amazing. You know, I had a really, really loving mother who nurtured me, and she instilled in me a lot of values. And one of them that I still think about to this day is that entrepreneurial spirit. You know, she started a catering company in the house when I was about 5 years
old. While she had a day job.
While she had a day job. Then she quit her day job and then did the catering full time. My sister and me became her first two employees. And
I bet she didn't pay you shit.
Nothing. Nothing.
That's not right. You and your sister should have gone on strike.
Should have went on strike. No, but I took it over doing laundry. So I'd rather peel shrimp and cut vegetables than take
and
out
separate
the trash
the whites from the
exactly
from the darks.
Exactly. You know, although I still ended up having to do that.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, that was our main focal point, and that was like life growing up was me, my mom, my sister.
And what did she cook?
She cooked a lot of things. You know, what she really took inspiration from was her Creole roots. You know, my family, her side of the family is from New Orleans, you know, Ville Platte, Louisiana. So you'll have etouffee, you have gumbo, you have peel and eat shrimp.
Yeah, and your grandfather had a pop-up. Your grandparents had a pop-up before they were called pop-ups.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, it was a pop-up for a while. And it was due to the circumstances of, you know, the American South in the 50s and 60s, you know, that wasn't very inviting to, you know, people of color in the dining scene. So a lot of African Americans had restaurants in the back of their houses.
Right.
In the barns. They had little speakeasies, you know, if you may, so just so they wouldn't be harassed.
Right.
You
know? So they were sort of like just to make some extra money. Right.
Extra money and also so they
and can, a gathering place.
And a gathering place, more important.
Like a third place, as you they
know,
say.
We all know that margins are razor thin in the restaurant industry, so I can only imagine what you could actually charge for a plate of food if it's in the back of your house. So I think it was more just to, one, they loved cooking. My family, I come from a long line of chefs, and yeah, they wanted to keep it going.
Yeah. And so your mother, did you feel the love she put in her food? You know, is that a difficult question? Because
no,
the circumstances were not easy.
No, it was not easy, but I did feel the love because I did go to my other friends' houses to eat. And the food did not taste the same.
Yes, you talk about going to your friends and they served you London broil.
Yeah.
And you asked the mother of your friends, like, how come this doesn't have any taste? I bet you weren't invited back.
I was. Yeah.
She forgave you?
She forgave me. It was one of those innocent things that you do as a kid when you're just being brutally honest and you don't know that you're being rude until someone, you know, looks at you sternly or says something very curt to let you know that you messed up.
Right.
So, and she let me know immediately.
So your mother had a day job till she didn't, mm-hmm. and she was catering, and you were helping to cater. So that was your introduction, as you say, to entrepreneurship, but also to serving food for a living.
Exactly. Yes, serving food for actual paying customers. You know, I don't want to offend certain listeners. There's a certain high about it, you know, mm-hmm. like being in the weeds, you know, prepping, putting stuff together, and then reaching that finish line moment when you're serving it to the guests, and all is well. You know, they're happy. Most of the times they're a little bit inebriated at these events, you know, and they're, you can see the genuine joy that they get when eating the food. And I love that moment. And I got addicted to it.
Right. So right from the get-go, you love that high.
Exactly. Exactly. And I wanted it because I saw my mother doing it. And obviously I wasn't the one, you know,
right.
interacting with the guests or anything like that. So it was something that I wanted for myself.
You were also a teenager.
Yes.
Which means you were a teenager, as you talk about in the book. You eventually moved to the Webster Houses in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And you fell prey to various things in the environment that...
Yeah, came a product of.
Even though you continued your entrepreneurial spirit, you also were dealing with some pretty heavy shit.
Yeah, yeah. It was a different perspective of life for mm-hmm. me, you know? It was something that I wasn't really privy to, and then I had to adapt when I was in that lifestyle.
And so you were...
And I had to survive.
Yeah, and you survive selling weed. First, you're selling punch.
Yeah.
I love that.
Nutcrackers.
Talk to us about nutcrackers.
So nutcrackers are... nutcrackers are like a jungle juice, you know, rum punch that they serve in the Bronx. I'm pretty sure they serve in Brooklyn. They serve it in Harlem, I know. And it's usually like somebody with a shopping cart going around. They have a shopping cart. It's full of ice, full of nutcrackers in these little sealed off containers, and they sell them for like $5.
And you put in some cheap alcohol.
Cheap alcohol, some juice, you know.
Hawaiian punch, whatever.
Whatever, exactly. And then
Sunny Delight.
whatever. No one shares their nutcracker recipe. I don't want to give it all away. Yeah, and so they would sell them like that. So when I got to school, you know, I was broke, you know, my parents did what they could to send me there, but from there I was on my own, and
right, you ended up at Cardinal Spellman High School,
mm-hmm.
which was a parochial school, a Catholic
yes.
school, right?
Yeah.
So in high school, your entrepreneurship was your nutcracker days.
No, in high school I worked at McDonald's.
Ah, okay.
Yes, that was my first job, and I loved it. It was great.
But you talk about in the book you were in part rebelling against your dad,
mm-hmm.
right? But you were, you know, who was difficult in many ways, as mm-hmm. you go into in the book. You end up joining, or you describe it as being a low-level member of the baby?
Yeah, the baby crew.
The baby yeah. crew, which was a Bloods-affiliated mm-hmm. crew?
Yeah.
What was that about, and what did you take away from that?
Well, it was a sense of belonging, you know, mm-hmm. unfortunately, you know, you want to belong to something when you're in that environment. You want to be a part of something, and you want camaraderie, usually in any environment. And that's where the camaraderie was from the people that I surrounded myself with.
Do you feel fortunate in getting out relatively unscathed from those days?
I feel very, very fortunate.
You talk about buying a piece in the book, and I'm like, damn, Kwame, you had a lot. You were swimming in some pretty...
Choppy waters.
Choppy waters, yeah. man.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I was very fortunate to come out unscathed from there. And the only thing that I have to tell are these stories, you know, and that's why I'm sharing them. you know, to let people know that there's, in America, there are these stories and they're real and they, you know, it doesn't matter where you come from, it's where you're going.
Yeah. And then you ended up at the University of Bridgeport,
mm-hmm.
and that's when you really upped your entrepreneurial game in the pot business.
Yes.
But then you got busted by the administration, right?
Yes.
So you just, but I love that you just, because first of all, I was busted for selling pot in college.
Okay.
So that's in my memoir, you know, which is not called Notes from a Young Black Chef.
It's not?
But you just moved your operation off campus.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was able to stay in, enrolled in school. I just had to move off campus, essentially, so.
When did that stop? Like,
so as
you're
reading
the book. And what forced it to stop?
Yeah, as you're reading the book, I had this, you know, come to light moment where I realized, as I was looking in the mirror, pretty much, like, who am I? Who is this guy right now? You know, I have stacks of money everywhere. You know, I have plethora of drugs. You know, I have all these people around me that I don't even know who they are.
Right.
And
you describe in the book waking up one morning, like, with somebody in your bed and people all strewn throughout your house.
Yeah.
And the house being totally wrecked.
Totally destroyed. Totally destroyed. And then Obama is walking across the stage accepting his presidency. And at that moment, for some reason, it clicked for me because, like, leading up to, you know, I went out, I voted for him, but I was like, there's no way we're going to get a black president. There's no way this is going to happen. No way. And when he walked across the stage, I was like, what am I doing? Like, this man defied the odds. You know, 55 years ago, we weren't even allowed to eat in restaurants. Like, that was the last restaurant
right.
that was desegregated. And now this man is walking across the stage. That's huge.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here selling drugs.
So it really, Obama had that profound and direct effect.
Absolutely, yeah.
The book is sort of a series of crossroads,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And it jumps around a little bit. It's not
right.
just like a
exactly.
perfect story.
But it's, look, all these stories, my story, your story, they're all nonlinear. That's why mm-hmm. we can tell them in a memoir.
Yes.
If it's a straight line, nobody wants to read it.
Yeah.
Right? It's boring.
It's boring.
So you end up having this moment where you're like, okay, which way am I going to go?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened?
I flushed all my drugs down the toilet. I gave away what I couldn't flush and bought a one-way ticket to, well, I called my mom and asked if I can come and stay with her, that I needed to come down. Yeah. I got
so you went to Baton Rouge
to Baton
first,
Rouge, Louisiana,
and you were
which was the complete opposite of where I come from.
And you talk about, like, what culture shock you suffered.
Yeah. Huge culture shock. Huge culture shock.
Just as a young black man.
Yeah, I never spent time in the South. So it was a clear divide, you know? I thought, I looked at it and it was like, segregation is still, this is still real. I mean, no, there's no laws, but, like, people are still just, like, split. And it was interesting. You know, I learned a lot about myself. And that's why I went down there, you know, to get away from my environment that I was becoming a product of so I can produce my own destiny,
yeah.
my own path.
You talk about working in restaurants down there.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from that period?
Being in Baton Rouge, it really taught me that it's the people that you surround yourself with can really propel you, essentially.
It does take a village.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think at any age, you know, your peers say a lot about you. And that's not any knock to the people that I grew up with in the Bronx. I love them, you know. Those are my brothers. But in order to get where I am today, I had to, like, get out of all of that and find out what I needed to do.
Yeah. Then you move to New Orleans, right? And you end up cooking on a ship.
Yes.
And that's the first time where you're really cooking,
mm-hmm.
right? Besides helping your mom.
In the, you know, as you know, you wrote a memoir. You
yeah.
put it all in there.
Exactly.
You know, it's kind of like boring. If you're like,
yeah.
and then I did this. And
right,
then I
right.
did this. So, like,
sure.
I worked on the line in a bunch of restaurants in New Orleans. But to your point, cooking my food.
Right.
This was the first time I was putting a menu together. That was the first time.
So you're cooking on a ship, and you talk about you were essentially the sous chef to this guy who really didn't care, you know, to say the least.
Yeah.
And he was sort of more than happy to give up the real responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so you started cooking your food, mm-hmm. which was, I'm sure, more your mother's food than anybody else's.
Absolutely, yeah.
And is that the first time you got the rush of, I can do what I want to do and people are responding?
Yeah. It was the first time I was like, I can cook. Like, I may not be a chef. I may not be, like, the most organized and I can do. But I at the rudiments of my craft, I am good at it. And I just need to build upon this.
Yeah. And the ship was one of those ships that they send out to clean up oil spills.
Yeah, as a responder.
You talk about, like, and it's true, and I started thinking, I've only seen oil spills on the news.
Mm-hmm.
When you see them up close, have been...
It was a sea of black as far as the eye could see. It was the most incredible thing I've ever seen in my life. The fumes.
Overwhelming.
Yeah, it was like 37 gas stations in your nose. You know? Like...
What a great image. 37 gas stations in your nose.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Should have used that in the book.
I should have. Next book. That's for the next one. It was very interesting, you know, especially the characters that were on that boat, you know, because they were from the shrimping communities in Houma, Louisiana. So they were there cleaning up that oil. The faster they clean up the oil, the faster they can get back to shrimping.
Got it.
You know? So they didn't look anything like me, you know, and it was... very scary walking onto that boat. And I had my assumptions just from the way that they looked. As soon as I got there, you know, you're reading the book and text asking me if I know how to read and using things like you people and you know what I mean? So like, which further confirmed my belief about the majority of the group. And I was so wrong.
Yeah.
These guys were like, it reminded me of the guys I grew up with back home in the Bronx.
Yeah, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then you end up moving back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
You have this catering company, Coterie. Yeah. You're trying to sort of invent yourself as a catering company, right? You don't really have any. I mean, you had your mom's experience, but it's hard to break into the New York catering world.
Oh, yeah.
But then you talk about something that I really want to talk to you about, which is selling candy in the subways.
Yes.
Because anybody who's ever been in the New York subway system has been confronted by somebody selling candy in the subway.
Not for a basketball team or
right.
Just to stay out of trouble.
Exactly. Yeah. Just to stay out of trouble. And I always wondered, even when it's for the basketball team, is it really for the basketball team? And then when you say, it turns out when you meet somebody else selling candy on the subway, that all my worst fears are confirmed that, in fact, the people selling the candy don't get to keep all the money.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm sure that there's some independent people out there like I was, but for the most part, it's an organized
It's kind
business.
Of like a racket.
It's a racket. It is.
Right? So, because you talk about being confronted by another group of kids selling candy on the subway, and they ask, where are you from? Mm-hmm. And when you mention a name and that you're from the Webster Houses, then they're okay with mm-hmm. it. And then you vow, okay, this is not for me.
No, no, no. I need to get out of the game.
But you have the biggest menu of any candy salesman I've ever seen on the subway. Because usually they only have like 3 items.
Yeah.
You had a lot of candy.
I had a lot. I had a lot. Yeah. I needed to compete. There's a huge market out there. There's a racket out there.
What'd you do with the money?
I started a catering company.
You actually
I formulated an LLC. I got insurance. I got all the things I needed to start really making some money.
So that is so awesome. I'm just, you know, that's the thing I'm going to most remember about your book is that you built your catering company on
candy
money sales. You made from candy sales in some way. What was the best-selling candy you had?
Peanut M&Ms.
Peanut M&M, not plain M&Ms.
Peanut M&Ms. People love peanut M&Ms.
I am, you know, that's an ongoing argument in the Serious Eats offices about whether you're a plain or a peanut person. I'm a peanut person too, mm-hmm. and now market research is now determining that I'm right.
Of people are peanut. I would go through 100 peanut M&Ms in like 3 hours.
So what couldn't you give away on your menu?
Nutter Butters.
Nutter Butters.
Nobody
wanted Nutter Butters.
I would have so many of them stocked because I would buy the variety pack of like Teddy Grahams, Nutter Butters, Oreos, and I would have so much Nutter Butters. And my roommate at the time loved Nutter Butters, so he would just be eating all the Nutter. I would lose all my profit from the Nutter Butters. Nutter Butters.
So, listen, we've been so busy discussing Nutter Butters that we haven't even gotten to how you actually entered Funarita as a chef, your education as a chef. So, Kwame Onwuachi, we're going to save that stuff for the next episode of Special Sauce with you. And at this moment, I have to say so long, Serious Eaters, and we'll see you next time, and you're going to stick around.
All right. See you next time.